This is Apollo Control Houston. Excuse me, 74 hours, 35 minutes into the flight. And in the last 10 or 15 minutes, we've had a couple of brief exchanges with the crew, who still seem to be in a rather resting mode. But here are these exchanges, primarily numbers updates. Can we have the tape?
Roger, Apollo 8 to Houston. I have a PEI 3, PEI 4, and map update for Rev 3 and 4 to read to you. Actually, the PEI 3 update, which you have on board, is still valid, so we will not update that one. Which do you want first, the PEI 4 or the map update?
PEI 4.
All right, this is the PEI 4 update, SPS / GNN. 4, 5, 6, 9, 5, minus 0, 5, 3, plus 1, 4, 1. Are you with me so far, over?
So far.
Very good. 0, 7, 7, 2, 1, 2, 7, 5, 8, plus 3, 0, 6, 2, 7, minus 0, 0, 6, 2, 5, plus 0, 0, 5, 7, 7, 1, 8, 0, 0, 1, 8, 0, 0, 1, not applicable, plus 0, 0, 1, 8, 8, 3, 0, 6, 3, 9, 2, 5, 6, 3, 0, 4, 5, 2. Are you with me so far, over?
So far, I see it's almost a whole minute, though, Ed.
Apollo Control here. We'll break it off at this point so the news conference can be picked up. One other pertinent comment that did not play out in that tape exchange. Frank Borman said we had noted that the voice quality of Bill Anders was not quite what it should be on the data record system in which he was being dumped here each rev back to Houston. This was noted, and Bill said they're all so busy right now, he'd do what he could, make notes on the flight plan and that sort of thing, but we just have to understand. So at this time, let's break over to the auditorium and pick up the news conference.
Okay, we're ready to start now. From my left, we have Glenn Lunny, flight director, Jerry Carr, the capsule communicator, Ed Pavelka, flight dynamics officer, and Dr. John Dietrich, a geologist of the Science and Applications Directorate. Pavelka's last name is spelled P-A-V-E-L-K-A. Dietrich's last name, D-I-E-T-R-I-C-H, John. And we'll start with Glenn, who'll...
Okay, before I briefly summarize the shift we've just been on, this is my second conference for the flight. Yesterday was my first one, and I came over here and told you that I was pleased to be over to attend my first conference, and today I'm even more pleased to be here and to tell you what has gone on the last few hours over in the control center and out around the moon as best as we can. I think I'll go over the shift work kind of lightly. I suspect that the best way we can get at what you might want to hear some more about is to get into the question and answer period, and hopefully we have the men here to answer most of what you would be interested in. We came on duty last night, about 64 hours elapsed. We were talking to Frank Borman at the time, and Jim Lovell got up shortly after that. We'd already passed the point of the going into the lunar sphere of influence, so we were falling towards the moon and increasing. Prior to going around the moon, at about 66 hours, we did a dump on the erasable memory. You recall last night that there was some difficulty with one of the realignments of the platform, the one that was done, oh, at about 60 hours or in the late 50s, I forget the exact time. What appears to be the problem is that the optics for not an unknown reason at this time actually moved off a little bit from the null, and then that the computer did not know that, and from the since it drives to the stars, assuming that the optics is at zero, it drove to the wrong number once that we knew of. And then when we got into discussion about it, Jim Lovell reported, the command module pilot, that it had done something similar to that in the previous day, and he cleared it up by just reselecting the program and proceeding. Now, the reason we did the erasable memory dump was that it's very likely that this sort of thing is just either an inadvertent or some form of hardware happening that we don't fully understand yet, but can obviously be worked around just by reselecting and doing it again. However, we did want to dump the erasable memory in the computer just to make sure that all the numbers in the computer were right and that there wasn't something subtle going on with the computer that could cause that to happen. We did that, and it was okay. We realigned the platform and used it for the mid-course. We did a couple of realigns on it, so we knew the platform was okay. We'd taken a lot of measurements on the gimbal angles and the accelerometers on the platform. And with the erasable memory, there was no question in our mind that the entire GNN system was in good shape and ready to do the LOI burn. That was the only area where we had some activity that we had to solve prior to committing to the lunar orbit insertion. All the other systems have continued to perform in the excellent fashion that we have been reporting to you in the last couple of days. At about 67 hours, some 2 hours prior to the actual lunar orbit burn, we went through what you could call, I guess, a rehearsal of the lunar orbit burn, and that we passed up to the commander a preliminary set of data for the lunar orbit burn. He went through the attitude maneuver to the burn attitude. He checked the sextant star, which is just to check that we have that the burn attitude is correct. He looks in the sextant, sees the star at the same shaft and trunnion angles that we read up. And he also checked the gimbal motors and the drive to the SPS bell, and he read back the response to that drive, so he knew that he had both control systems which can drive the SPS bell. We had some more pad data to pass up. The pad data that we passed up there after we passed up the first lunar orbit insertion pad was mostly precautionary data. As you can see in the flight plan and as you will hear today, we will keep the pilots updated on information which they could use to do a trans-earth injection on both the current rev that we're on and the subsequent rev. So they will have, for example, going in lunar orbit, we wanted to make sure that they had both the data to do a trans-earth injection on the first opportunity after one rev and on the second opportunity on the second rev. The pads went up. Bill Anders was up and around at about 68 hours. He had taken a second all to help go to sleep and get a couple hours sleep. He probably got about 4 hours prior to the LOI activity. We still have yet to get a full sleep report from Bill Anders on the period immediately previous to the lunar orbit burn, but I suspect it'll be about 4 hours. And then the last hour was relatively quiet, actually, in mostly monitoring on the ground and the crew setting up the cockpit to do the burn. The LOS, or loss of signal, to the Earth as the vehicle went behind the moon was very close, as near as anyone can tell, to the numbers that we had predicted. And again, we stood by for a while, what for many of us was a very long time, it seemed, for the vehicle to come back around the other side of the moon and reacquire. We did reacquire, and very quickly were able to establish that the burn went very well as far as could be monitored on board, and it was soon verified by the tracking that the orbit was just about exactly what we wanted. Ed Pavelka has these numbers. You can discuss them with him a little later. The one thing that was happening when the pilots came from behind the moon was that the evaporator, the primary evaporator, which, as you recall, we will use in lunar orbit to augment the radiators, was not operating properly. What appears to have happened is that the water in the evaporator dried out since the last time we serviced it, which was a long time ago, actually. The lunar module pilot, Bill Anders, resurfaced the evaporator and put it back online, and it functioned properly. In the meantime, we brought up the secondary evaporator, and it worked just fine while we were resurfacing the primary. Those of you who covered Apollo 7 recall that we went through this cycle several times on Apollo 7. The primary evaporator is now carrying the load along with the primary radiators, and the secondary coolant loop system is off. Just to give you some examples, when we were on the way out to the moon, the temperature out of the radiators was running about 40 degrees. In lunar orbit, because of the reflected heat from the lunar surface, the radiator out temperature is running about 60 degrees, 62 degrees, so we do the final 20 degrees of cooling with the evaporator. And the rest of the activity during that first pass was primarily looking at the data, getting the dump data from the first burn, taking a look at all the parameters that we can on the SPS engine and confirming back to the crew that everything looked okay, and we gave them a go to go around another rev. We also talked to them about the filters for the TV pass. Coming up on the second revolution, which was a TV pass and which was essentially going when we got acquisition, that pass went normally. Everyone saw the TV, and I guess the best way to proceed on that subject is to wait until we get into questions and answers. I spent most of my time, I guess like Frank Borman did, I was more involved with how the systems were working and how the engine had worked, etc., at that time than what the pictures looked like or some of the description. Also, there was another comment made that was interesting. I have talked about the fact that the radiators were a little warmer in lunar orbit. Another indication of this is that Jim Lovell reported that the ice appeared to be melting on the center window, the number three window right in the middle of the hatch, which is an indication of the warmer environment that we're in around the moon. We gave a go for the LOI-2 burn based on our analysis of the engine and the performance of the control system, etc. LOI-2 was read up to the crew, the pad for LOI-2, the burn information, I should say, for the second lunar orbit burn. We did a couple of housekeeping kind of things. We had to cycle the fans and the cryos to be sure that they were in good shape and there was not any stratification building up there. That went okay. Going behind the moon on the second time, I should say the third time behind the moon, the crew did the LOI-2 burn. I left the control center shortly after the discussions we had as the crew came around after that burn. As near as we can tell at this time, that burn went completely nominally. The performance of the systems, again, are nominal. And as far as we can tell, we have a completely go spacecraft. The activity for the rest of the day, in all likelihood, will go pretty much as you see laid out in the flight plan. We have the revs laid out for photography work, the first couple of revs, and then 5, 6, 7, and 8, the work on those revs will be concentrated on the landmark tracking. I'm sure we hope that during the 20 hours off and on, the different men can get a couple hours sleep. Trans-Earth injection tonight. and I'm sure the next shift that comes over to brief will have some more information on the details of the planned nominal trans-earth injection tonight. A brief statement, I guess, on consumables. We have slowly been catching up on the RCS residuals, on the RCS consumables. When we left the control center, we were in very good shape on the RCS. The work that the pilots were doing in lunar orbit, the tracking, et cetera, seemed to be running about the kind of numbers we expected. So all that bodes well for the status of the RCS during the lunar orbit. The status of the consumables, the oxygen and hydrogen consumables, continues to be one of a very comfortable posture for us. We can get back to the Earth at the nominal time on one cryo tank in both the oxygen and the hydrogen system at this time, one of the two tanks which we have in each with each of those cryogenics. I guess that summarizes what we have. I have, I guess, one other thought, which is perhaps more administrative than anything else. We will probably have some questions here today that we can't answer or may not have with us. I suggested to John McLeish last night that for those of you who may have a question which I or whoever else comes over here wouldn't be carrying around in our head, we might be able to better get you the answer if you're able to get them to John or somebody in the PAO a little bit early, because there's only so much we can remember and carry over here when we come here. But let's see what we can do today.
Okay, we're open now for questions. Gentleman right here.
Reference was made to a crater called Pickering, and I'm told that there are a couple of Pickerings around on the moon's surface. Do we know what Lovell was referring to?
Yes, it's the pair of craters in the Sea of Fertility that is labeled on... It is a pair of craters in the Sea of Fertility that are on some maps listed as Messier and Messier A, I believe it is, or it may be A and B, but it's a twin pair of craters. An old name for one of them is Pickering. M-E-S-S-I-E-R, I believe.
I would like to make the following question. Are you considering the positioning of communication satellites around the moon in order to avoid the communications block while the, a spacecraft is traveling on the far side of the moon?
That concept has been discussed. However, there are no plans to implement a vehicle to accomplish that at this time that I know of.
I have two questions. One, we got the impression that they had the TV on as they came around from behind on that first transmission. It seemed to burst right in on us, and I wondered if that was the case. The other thing was I wondered what problems have been introduced by the time lag due to the distance. I noticed at one point they had a 1-2-3 mark, and I wondered what that was and whether you cranked in here the time delay that is intrinsic to the distance.
Well, I think that on your first question, I think the TV was on at just about the time of acquisition, and that was all part of locking up the station. As far as the mark goes, yes, there's some difference in the time just due to the speed of light of transmissions. However, it seems to me that the mark isn't off more than a second or two, and generally we're dealing with something that doesn't have to be any more accurate than that. Plus, I guess, mentally anticipated some kind of a discontinuity in conversations, but we don't seem to be having that. Maybe Jerry will comment on that, as busy he's been at that.
To lag a little bit between question and response more than when they were...
That's mostly due to thinking, I think, rather than...
We have tried to crank in a little delta to take account of the time lag. We're allowing 2 seconds, and I think one of the marks that you probably heard was a time hack that I gave them about 8 minutes from LOS going into the going around the corner for the LOI burn. What I did is I started at 12 and counted, called that 10 and counted down, and 2 was Mark. And by the time he got it, he was at 0 on his counter. So that's how we did it.
John, what was the atmosphere in the Mission Control Center at the time of LOI? I heard some faint yelling and whatnot.
You mean at what time of that we acquired?
At that time of acquisition.
I would describe it as a sort of a moving drama to me, but I'm not sure I can. Yeah, it.
From inside, it certainly wasn't faint.
No.
I said from the moker itself, it certainly wasn't a faint reaction. There was quite a bit of racket, quite a stir.
I'm sure it can be described as one of the happiest Christmas Eves just about anybody there had seen. Let's take our tail, and then we'll get back over this way.
Dr. Dietrich, as a geologist, what has interested you most about what the astronauts have done so far in their lunar orbits?
Well, they have, first of all, demonstrated their ability to observe from the spacecraft to a degree that I think surprised most of us, because the earlier observations were in an area that we had expected to be somewhat blanked out because of the high sun angle. And the demonstrated ability to observe details in these areas, and of course this improves as you approach the terminator, was most encouraging to those of us that were in the science support area. The ability to observe details at the higher sun angles that were present when the TV came on. Their descriptions were much more graphic, of course, than the picture, because the eye responds better than the camera.
Dr. Peter, can you tell us, as you looked at the pictures, where the TV started, in latitude and longitude, and where it terminated? In other words, what part of this lunar track did the TV start and finish?
Spacecraft was oriented, so they were looking back along the path that they had traveled. So they were looking eastward while the spacecraft was traveling generally westward. The spacecraft gave us the first signals at about 110 degrees or 115 degrees east, because it was above the surface. They were looking back slightly behind them. That's about right. They were looking back behind them along the path that they had traveled, so they probably went out to about 120 degrees or so east with their photo coverage. It took me a while to get organized, so I don't know exactly what was on the first few seconds. I would like to pass that question to the flight crew support.
You want to take that one, Jerry?
Yeah, I'll take that one. As I remember, the first crater he called out was Brand, and that crater is at about 10 south, 125 east. That's right. The craters that we've called Bassett and C were out pretty close together at about 25 south, 110 east. C is just right about on those two, on that point, and Bassett is a little bit further south. Okay, the track, I quite frankly don't remember.
They went through.
They went to the
Smith
Terminator.
Smith C. They didn't get to the Terminator.
They went through Smith C. So that would put it at around something like 5 south, 75 east. That's just a little bit past Smith C, right around the craters Kastner and Gilbert. No. Mm-mm.
dimensions no, angry, and some of those craters further west.
Yeah, let's wait for the mics if we can.
Has enough time elapsed to get any kind of a determination on the effect of the mass GOMs on the orbit?
Well, I'll let Ed talk about this a little. Ed Pavelka talk about it a little more, but they are detectable. For example, when the vehicle was passing over the some of the major areas like Copernicus, the men in the tracking area look at something that they call residuals, which is just a observed measurement minus a theoretical computed measurement, the best one they have at that time, and they could see it a jiggle like noise in the measurement at that time, as if there were a mass concentration effect on the measurement itself, or I should say the theoretical computed compared to the observed. I guess I would also say that it seems to be, although it's very early to tell, that the accuracy that that we have on the orbit is pretty good, even with that mass concentration at the moon, about which we do not know too much yet, at least at the altitudes we're flying. So I don't know if I've helped any, but you can see that they're there.
Do you feel they have any effect on future flights landing?
Well, I think the thing that that we're trying to learn on this flight is to understand exactly what the effect of the lunar gravitational field is at the altitudes we're at, and hopefully with the data we get from this flight, we'll be able to work that back in and minimize, if not make zero, any effect like that. Yes.
Physical side of things. Have you had any more tape reports on astronauts' conditions, and how did this work-sleep cycle get off right up to the point of the LOI? Jim was the only one resting just prior to LOI, wasn't he? LOI 1?
Prior to LOI, Jim Lovell and Bill Anders had a flight plan allotment of about 7 hours. I don't know how much sleep Jim got, but Bill got probably about 4 hours at that time. And as near as I can make out, we are close to being back on the flight plan sleep cycle, which in lunar orbit is kind of small. But we get off of it kind of in the beginning of the flight when we had the need to sleep the minute more often.
Have you had anything else on the condition?
No. You've heard everything that has come down on the condition. They all seem to be feeling genuinely better and genuinely more chipper than they were in the early stages of the flight.
Okay, let's take one from behind. Bill Shelton now.
I have a question on the naming of the lunar features again. Could you tell me what criteria were used in selecting these code names, which I understand are not official yet? Approximately how many features are so named, and what liberty or what plan does the crew have for naming additional features at will during this flight?
Well, I guess the first thing we ought to say is that the names that had been put there are very unofficial, I guess as unofficial as you can get, and the requirement really was to have some names for some of these unmarked craters, and they were arbitrary and just a convenient way to call them out. Frankly, I'm glad to stop reading numbers and letters back and forth and glad to hear a name or two.
I want to get back to this matter of the track during that television pass and see if we're not a little confused here. If I heard you correctly, you said that the track terminated at about 5 South 75 East, but we kept hearing from these people about the Sea of Fertility, which is at like about 50 East. We heard Maskelyne, which is at 30 East, and so forth. I just want to get sync with you. Are we talking about the same pass?
Yes, sir, I think we are. I guess I got into a little too much detail there. Now, when we came across the first time, prior to the TV orbit, the second rev, as I remember, the first crater that was named by Jim Lovell was Langrenus.
Yes.
And then they steamed on off the other side. He talked about the Sea of Fertility, Tarantius, pardon me.